This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest We Love Spunk edition. It's Wednesday, February 1st, 2017. On today's show, the feature film Elle stars the great French actress Isabelle Huppert as a woman coming to grips with the fact of her brutal sexual assault that took place in her own home. The movie is directed by Paul Verhoeven. And then This Is Us is a huge, huge hit on NBC. This is almost like the empire of network TV is striking back with a big theme, warm-hearted, mass audience, crowd-pleasing show. It seems to have done all those things, warm hearts on a mass basis. We discussed with Slate's own Laura Bennett. And finally, Mary Tyler Moore, I would say along with Lucille Ball, it's fair to say she was the greatest television comedian of all time and a woman who spearheaded a comedy and a feminist revolution. She has died, and we will discuss her remarkable legacy. Joining me today is Slate's editor, Julia Turner. Julia, you realize you occupy that seat thanks only to Mary Tyler Moore's Mary Richards.
Absolutely. All of the conference rooms at Slate are named after fictional journalists, and the one that I use most frequently is named Richards in honor of Mary Tyler Moore's Mary Richards.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's so fantastic. And of course, Dana Stevens, who is, she occupies her seat as Slate's film critic solely on her own merits.
There didn't need to be any tossed berets for me to sit in my place. No, on the contrary, I owe everything to Mary.
We all do. All right, before we dig in, Julia, presumably some business, yeah?
We do. In fact, we have four pieces of business today. Number one, in our Slate Plus segment, we will be talking about the controversial ending of Elle. If you have seen Elle or if you have read about Elle, you know that its ending is controversial. So we will get into spoilers in plus. We'll live up to the French pronunciation of
yeah,
plus.
It's slowly becoming a 100% French segment.
And we will dig into the end of the film and what it means about the film's ideas and themes and merits. If you are a member of Slate Plus, you will hear that after the show. If you are not yet a member, you can join at slate.com/culture plus to get ad-free versions of this show and all our shows, bonus segments of this show and many of our shows, and to support Slate and the journalism that we do. Again, that's slate.com/culture plus. Number two, we are coming to the great city of Washington, D.C. for the first time ever to do a live show. I mean, we're not coming there for the first time ever. We are doing a live show there for the first time ever. I believe we've all been to our nation's capital. I lived there for a while. We will be doing that on April 19th. The link to buy tickets is not yet available, but circle the date in red on your calendars and hold all calls. We will be very excited to see you there in our nation's capital. Number three, I am hosting an event in Brooklyn next week on the evening of February 9th, which I believe is a Thursday, at Powerhouse Books in Dumbo. I will be interviewing Dr. Michael Bennett and and his daughter Sarah Bennett about their new book, Fuck Love, which is the follow-up to their wildly successful self-help book, Fuck Feelings, which take a, as you can tell from the titles, very no-nonsense and practical approach to advice. Their shtick is basically applying cognitive behavioral therapy and the notion that the way to a happier life is not actually understanding the traumas that your parents put you through or anyone else in your life, but just looking at the world and very realistically assessing the likelihood that anything around you is going to change and becoming okay with that and how to do that. It's really great, practical, smart advice delivered very amusingly. And I think we're going to do some fun advice events at this event at Powerhouse Books in Brooklyn on February 9th. So if you're in Brooklyn, come out. That's a great, great bookshop in Dumbo, and they are very fun, smart, and lively people. And finally, you may have heard the bestseller on Amazon at the moment is 1984 by Steve's personal champion and hero, George Orwell. I've never read it. Steve, have you read it?
It's funny you should ask that, Julia. I have never read 1984.
And Dana, you've read it, right?
I just don't understand how you graduated high school. Yes, I think I read it for high school.
No one understands how I graduated high school, Dana. It was assigned to me at least twice, and I blew it off twice. But then later, I should explain, very quickly, later in life, Orwell became a hero because of his nonfiction. And so I read all of that non-homework, non-assigned Orwell. In fact, every word of his nonfiction I've tried to read, published, you know, nonfiction.
But you've held out on 1984 until 2017. So we will be reading Orwell over the next few weeks, and we will discuss it in a couple weeks on the show. If you have either read 1984 or were planning to read it again or would like the opportunity to pick it up, we're going to do a little Orwell book club, and we will be discussing that book on the show. All right, that's enough business for one day. Steve, let's commence.
Thanks, Julia. Okay, L, the feature film L. It stars Isabelle Huppert, the miraculous French actress, as Michelle LeBlanc, a personally and professionally powerful and successful career woman. She's divorced. She's brutally raped in her own upper bourgeois Parisian home. What follows is a careful, or one might say intriguing, study in both coping and denial, in gender politics, and finally the nature of sexual violence and consent. It's directed by Paul Verhoeven. I really want to get into that aspect of it with Dana. Paul Verhoeven's, of course, known for 80s schlock noir films like Basic Instinct and RoboCop. Prior to that, he did make European art, sort of arty films. This seems to be a kind of bizarre melange of both. We'll get into all of that. Plus, Huppert, who was nominated for Best Actress, deservingly, is truly miraculous in the film. Why don't we listen to a clip?
It's French. Do we want to listen to a clip?
Oh, do we? All right. Well, we would listen to a clip normally under these circumstances, Dana Stevens, but the movie is in French, and only you are fluent in French.
In all the world.
Yes.
Il n'y a que moi et Isabelle Huppert.
But let me start with you. This film is... it could be said to begin and end with the remarkable performance of Isabelle Huppert, but it doesn't. So let's first acknowledge that if for nothing else, one should see it for her extraordinary performance. The rest of the movie is quite complicated. It's not possible to have uncomplicated feelings about this movie, I would assert. I'm very curious to know what your complicated feelings are.
Yeah, I think I'm still working mine through in spite of having seen it twice and written on it and talked about it in the movie club. I still feel like I haven't quite gotten what Elle was setting out to do, and so I can't say whether it accomplished what it was setting out to do. I mean, I think something that you just said, Steve, is very important. It's come up in a lot of the criticism of the film, both on the positive and negative side, which is that it's an actor as auteur kind of film. You know, it's a movie that you can't imagine without this actress in the role, and I think she brings degrees of nuance to the script that were not in the script itself. How to categorize my reaction? For one thing, upon first seeing this movie, I immediately knew I would have to see it again before writing on it because I was completely unsure of its tone vis-a-vis the main character and these events you talk about and sexual violence and gender. I mean, it was throwing so many provocative ideas out about all these things that I really walked out having no idea what it was trying to say and knowing that I would have to see it again in order to write on it, while at the same time really not wanting to see it again because it's a very graphic, brutal, and hard to sit through movie in some ways. Although with lots of laughs as well, those kind of Paul Verhoeven laughs where you're laughing at the kind of nihilistic, bizarre intensity of it all. I think the two earlier Paul Verhoeven films that would come to mind for me in thinking about Elle you didn't mention, and that would be Showgirls and Starship Troopers, both of which are movies that I love and that that take apart a genre in a kind of sick-minded and very smart way. Starship Troopers, I think, is his masterpiece and really an important movie that Paul Verhoeven made. But to see him and Isabelle Huppert coming together in this way, and like you say, marrying the kind of French art film and the, you know, the characters in this film live in this sort of Frenchy intellectual upper bourgeois world that's familiar from a lot of kind of classic French comedies. He brings that together with something like, I don't know, not horror, but a sort of rape suspense thriller or rape revenge fantasy. And all of those things coexist in this big muddle that's hard to talk about without spoiling. But I would say on the whole that I think this movie fails. I think it fails mainly in the last 20 to 30 minutes, which we won't be able to get into until our plus section on the spoiler. But in spite of the fact that it fails, I think if you're interested in any of the topics that we're talking about, if you're interested in gender violence on film, or if you just want to see Isabelle Huppert just tear up a really difficult character to play, it's still worth seeing. With a trigger warning, actually, which we have not given many of on this podcast. But yeah, there's some hard to watch stuff in this movie, and it starts from frame one.
Frame one, yes. No, I totally agree with that. Julia, dying to know what you thought of this movie.
I don't know what I thought of this movie. I just watched it last night, and I experienced it as a suspense thriller, and then afterwards went and read a bunch of reviews that called it a black comedy, and I was like, well, fuck, I just experienced that as a suspense thriller, not a black comedy.
But didn't you laugh at times?
I totally laughed, and I also experienced it, this is going to sound odd, perhaps, but the other genre it reminded me of is Nancy Meyers movies, like sort of the domestic comedies of Nancy Meyers, who does all those kind of Diane Keaton movies.
The House Envy movies.
Middle-aged women who have more sex drive than other movies might impute to them and who like just gad about in beautiful houses dallying with various handsome men. Like there was a bit of a lifestyle porn quotient to this movie, which, you know, always happens when you watch movies set in glamorous other cultures to a degree, but I don't think it was just the American viewing of the movie. Like, I think it's intentional. Mm-hmm. She lives in this sumptuous home. She has like an array of fascinating sconces in her living room. she throws like a terrible Christmas dinner with like, you know, very elegant little cups for the wine. And
that dinner scene is funny as hell. And there I would say that the very bourgeois lifestyle you're pointing to, rather than in Nancy Meyers where you just kick back and enjoy it, that atmosphere is very, you know, oppressive and dangerous.
Oh, yes. Everybody's mean to each other. I mean, it's blacker than in Nancy Meyers in spirit, but there's sort of this sense of like what a kick-ass woman, what a great life she has. She's such a bitch. She's so mean to everybody. She's thoughtlessly cruel all over the place to all kinds of people in her life. And yet you're kind of rooting for her. So that's confusing as well. I agree with you, Dana, that the end of the film, she both make some conscious decisions in the final chunk of the film that you might not agree with as a viewer, and also a crucial decision she does not make, and both of those things are weird. But I find myself slightly stymied. I mean, to me, the most radical thing about the movie is she is a rape victim from the first scene of the movie, and she does not behave in the ways that you might expect a rape victim to act on film or in life. And she rejects the role of victim in a very aggressive way. And I can't tell whether the movie is presenting that as a kind of radical problematization of victimhood. Like perhaps everyone should reject victimhood in the way that Isabelle Huppert does, or whether it's presenting her as just an incredibly damaged woman, and that's why she responds in such a strange way to the assault.
Right, and without spoiling too much, we can say that there's a little bit of flashback material in her childhood that shows why she might have become a traumatized person who handles rape in such a strange way. Yeah,
right. So what I would say about this movie is, first of all, I finished it and wanted to see it again immediately without really liking or not liking it. It seemed to almost go beyond that. I did feel strongly that the first hour of the movie is perfect or nearly perfect, and not only for Huppert. Huppert is the reason to see the movie no matter what. But there were other reasons, too, that I thought were handled with astonishing deftness by Verhoeven in the first hour and the scriptwriter. The first is that, in addition, Julia, exactly right, to her being a kind of a woman so powerful in both sort of personality and social position that her reaction to the rape is completely unexpected. That was remarkable. But the fact that they made her a video game producer, that the nature of her success, she's not in couture or you know, she's not some, you know, high-end restaurateur or something. She makes violent video game content. I thought that was cunning. Turn, a very unexpected and cunning turn. She's not only comfortable with the degree of highly sexualized violence, she makes her fortune off of it, and she does it by being very hands-on in every level of her business. She runs it both as a business and as a creative presence. Those relationships, I thought, were highly specific and completely believable. I agree also with Dana that the problems the film runs into are ones of such almost kind of 80s excess. I mean, they did really remind me. Suddenly, it didn't seem to me very much like a Verhoeven film at first, and then seemed way too much like a Verhoeven film towards the end. And it started to remind me of his use of schlock in movies like Showgirls and RoboCop in ways that flouted what was so perfect about the first part, which was this impossible balance between the French comedy of manners. The dinner party scene to me is just a perfect execution of a very familiar trope from French movies, upper bourgeois French comedies of manners, you know, a bunch of people from different backgrounds getting together and being, you know, super intellectualized but repressing what's really going on, very awkward and very hostile with one another. It's just pulled off absolutely exquisitely. He managed to balance the French comedy of manners with the sort of slightly schlocky overdone thriller, and then lost the balance sort of tragically. But I didn't ultimately care. I really want to see it again, and I felt kind of deeply challenged by it. But Dana, what I would say is that, without spoiling anything, one feature of the movie, as you point to, is her past. Her as a child, some extraordinarily traumatic thing happened to her. Not only happened to her, made her famous, made her infamous in French life. That struck me as overdone from the beginning, and it, in a weird way, kind of just unnecessary.
I agree. I think that whole subplot, and I won't get into what it was, but involving her childhood and her childhood trauma was superfluous and could have been cut out of the film, and was a moment that it just seemed to be slipping into Grand Guignol, as you say, schlock. Yes. For the sake of it.
Right. The question of, like, what does a woman feel, which are the places where the movie is most interesting. What does a woman feel after she's been raped? What does a woman feel about being a daughter? What does a woman feel about being a mother, both of which are also things about which the character articulates non-mainstream views.
Yeah, she's not just a woman, right? It's almost like, what does this extremely idiosyncratic character...
Idiosyncratic and rejecting very specific types of womanhood. She's an incredibly aggressive, confrontational boss. She is neither a great mom nor a great daughter.
But her attitude toward her son is one of the most hilarious things about the movie. Her son is sort of this overgrown lug who's very infantile and can't keep a job and really just is bumbling through life. And the way that she continuously cuts him down is one of the movie's more amusing aspects.
Yeah. So as just sort of a woman who's rejecting classic responses in all kinds of ways, that's fascinating. And part of what you wonder is, okay, so what's being articulated here? Is this an embrace of this woman's iconoclasm? Are we to understand her as damaged or strange? Is this just French culture's version of a Nancy Meyers movie? Is like BDSM fantasy and c'est la vie? But but with this gnarled backstory, you sort of get into multiple levels of victimhood that are being rejected that make you have to go down philosophical wormholes that don't actually strike me as interesting as the questions raised by her performance itself.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I believe here, unless I'm wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, we're at that perfect point in the conversation to say we were deeply intrigued by it. Huppert is transporting. It's really an extraordinary performance. I'm rooting hard now for her to win the Academy Award. But to talk about this movie further is to really spoil it, and spoil it in ways that I think would harm the viewing experience of our listeners who haven't seen it. So why don't we cut off here? Slate Plus listeners can tune in and hear us fully spoil the film and delve into that other aspect of it. But I would say, going around the table, I would say, completely, almost totally unreserved thumbs up.
Not me.
I would say skip
it. Really?
Yeah. I mean, I'm excited to have the rest of this conversation with you guys, but I actually feel like the end of the movie is such a moral failure that it makes the question, the potentially interesting questions raised, not interesting at all.
Oh, I can't wait for our plus conversation
wow.
now. Yeah, I think say I'm going to recommend with extreme reservations. I think if the content sounds off-putting to you and you just don't want to see, you know, a lot of scary violence against women, don't see it. If you expect this in any way to be a sort of uplifting revenge, you know, I will get revenge on my rapist kind of narrative, don't see it because you'll be disappointed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But if you're very curious about, you know, a bravura acting performance that seems pretty likely to be a contender for the Oscar, it might be worth it for that alone. And if you're just a completist of Verhoeven, as I am, I'm just curious to see what he does next because he's somebody who's always flip-flopped all over the map from country to country and genre to genre.
Okay, well, I don't disagree with either one of those assessments, but I just trend heavily in the direction of if you get beyond the trigger aspect of it, do see it, if nothing else, for Isabelle Huppert. Okay, the movie is Elle, stars Huppert, directed by Paul Verhoeven. There are going to be a range of very intense opinions about this movie. Please come express them at facebook.com/culturefest. Would love to pursue the dialogue further there. Okay, this is us as an ensemble dramedy about people who share the same birthday. Oh my. I will say right up front that the premise of the show is a mild spoiler in the pilot. If you really don't want to know what that is, skip ahead. But I think most people familiar with the show, even from the reviews, will know what I'm about to say. And that is that the people who share the same birthday principally are two twins, one of whom is a perennially obese sister, the other is her super cut and star of a highly successful sitcom brother, and the third, spoiler alert, is their adopted brother, who was abandoned the same day that they were born. They were all born the same day, and he was adopted by the twins' parents, and they were raised as triplets, and here's a second twist. They are white, he is black. The show is created by Dan Fogelman, who's known as the scriptwriter behind Tangled and creative genius behind Crazy Stupid Love. Why don't we listen to a clip?
Hey, yeah, stop all that banging. I heard you the first time banging on the door.
Who the hell is
my name is Randall Pearson. I'm your biological son.
36 years ago, you left me at the front door. But now, hold on, just let me say this. 36 years ago, you left me at the front door of a fire station. Now, don't worry, I'm not here because I want anything from you. I was raised by two incredible parents. I have a lights-out family of my own. And that car you see parked out in front of your house cost $143,000, and I bought it for cash. I bought it for cash because I felt like it and because I can do stuff like that. Yeah. You see, I turned out pretty all right. Which might surprise a lot of folks, considering the fact that 36 years ago, my life started with you leaving me on a fire station doorstep with nothing more than a ratty blanket and a crap-filled diaper. I came here today so I could look you in the eye, say that to you, and then get back in my fancy-ass car and finally prove to myself and to you and to my family who loves me that I didn't need a thing from you, even after I knew who you were.
You want to come in?
Okay.
All right. Well, to discuss the show, we're joined by Slate's culture editor, Laura Bennett. Laura, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm psyched to have you here, but I'm going to play a little bit of a funny on you, which is that I'm going to throw at you the words of Willa Paskin, Slate's TV critic. Not quoting them precisely, but the general tone of her review is that this show is sick-making. Why do you like it?
Well, I've told Willa this. I think that review is the single wrongest piece of criticism she's written in her esteemed career.
But also among perhaps the funniest.
It's very funny. But just, woof. I loved it when I read it and I hadn't watched the show, and I trembled with rage rereading it a few days ago after I'd become a full This Is Us bandwagoner.
I just need to point out that the first paragraph of Willa's review of This Is Us contains the phrase, a gangrenous nub, which gives you some sense of the tone.
I believe the headline was the rotten cheese of This Is Us, which I wrote at the time. I had no idea.
All right, well, Laura, this is about your opinion, not Willa's. I want you to go ahead and defend the gangrenous nub.
It would be a pleasure. So I, you know, I've seen every episode of This Is Us. I've watched them avidly. I look forward to coming home at night and watching this show. I think what This Is Us has done so effectively is, in sort of counterintuitively, it's staked out some genuinely new real estate in the network TV landscape. So network TV is full of, you know, procedurals and fixers and superheroes, these kind of broad stroke operatic shows. And the more small bore, kind of fine-toothed domestic portraiture has mostly been relegated to or kind of co-opted by cable, by sort of prestige TV at this point. So there's actually kind of nothing like it on network TV, and it has become this kind of warm-hearted counter-programming to everything else that's going on in the world right now. And I think what makes it so good is that it basically has – it hits all the emotional beats of a schmaltzy network drama. It's, you know, melodramatic. It's soapy. But it kind of has the texture of a prestige drama in some ways. It really rewards rewatching. So if you pay close attention to it – okay, I don't want to give away any of the major plot twists here, but there are so many of them that I'm going to have to give some of them away. There is this dual timeline trick going on that we learn at the end of the pilot, basically that we think we've been watching the parallel stories of all these people, but it turns out that one of the sort of vignettes we're following are the parents of the three other people who were following in the pilot. And if you look closely, it turns out that there are little hints that the timelines are different. So there's a box of photos that says 72 on it, and the medical equipment in the hospital is kind of dated, but only if you inspect it really closely. And
but then after the reveal, suddenly everybody's wearing polyester and smoking in hospitals and proving that it's the 70s.
And it's like, right, I know. It's like a total period drama. And obviously, the characters are really interesting, I think, in ways that are unusual for a network show. I just think that this is, I mean, it's a really good sort of textured show if you pay close attention to it.
All right. Well, I'm going to leap right to my opinion, which is that everything you just said would make me hate it. And I freaking love this show.
What?
Julia Turner, what has happened to me?
That's like the single most surprising opinion you've had in 8 years.
I'm so
say
happy
more.
I've been body snatched.
No. Him watching The Bachelor and The Bachelorette religiously is the most surprising.
Okay,
Steve-alation.
Fine. Second most surprising Steve-alation.
Why did I? What happened to me? Why did who coshed me on the head and rendered me senseless? I couldn't laugh harder. I loved it. It was so heartwarming. It was.
But when you say you couldn't laugh harder, you mean that you were laughing when you were meant to laugh, or did
yes,
you watch it in a second revolution?
I laughed. I cried. I laughed. I cried. Dennis Stevens. The poignancy of it just affected me through and through. Take me out of here in a freaking straitjacket. Switch my meds. I like This Is Us.
How many episodes did you watch, Steve?
Trump has broken me down. I watched the first two, and I thought, why? It's you cannot. Okay, first of all, let's focus here, people. Julia Turner, why don't I start with you? Whatever else is true about this show, it is very well crafted by someone who knows what he is doing. The writing is extremely sharp. It may not be your jam, but the deftness with which it was made is undeniable. Am I at least correct in asserting that?
Yeah. I mean, I will confess that I started watching this show with idle curiosity, expecting not to like it, and then suddenly fell into a wormhole and had watched six of them in a row while lying in my bed on Friday, and like slacking Laura, who was at a wedding, and just
sure
basically
was.
Being like, I'm crying. I actually wanted to like live slack more things to you, and I was like, I shouldn't
no,
bother
I wish you
Laura.
Did. I loved all I want to do is talk about This Is Us at all moments,
okay,
even
well,
on the dance floor.
I'm gonna keep that in my pocket for future viewings. But I watched six episodes and don't really respect myself for how much I enjoyed it, but maybe I just should. I would say that the most sophisticated thing about the show is the plotting. It has like Agatha Christie level, like excellent soap opera plotting. Like there are cliffhangers and twists at the end of nearly every episode. They are just piling on the plot. I mean, they are going through plot. You know, one thing that's striking about these family dramas is that in a procedural or a superhero show where there's a bad guy to fight, the personal drama plot is like the B story or the C story, and you don't go through it as fast. But this thing you know, you see things in episode 2 that become big reveals in episode 5, and it's like, oh my God, what's going to happen by episode 20? Like,
that's genius.
They are going through it. So it's unclear how baroque the conflicts will get by the end of its run. But for the moment, it's very satisfying to watch. The characters are all too good to be true. Like, the conflicts don't really come from anybody being an asshole. All the conflicts come from people just trying to love each other right, but they just can't always communicate. So, like, all the marriages are, like, you know, people are just really trying. They, like, really want to do right by each other. But life is hard, guys. Yeah. And you're just like, it is hard. And
oh, my God. I hate myself. So much. I hate myself so much right now.
That's exactly right.
This is really like a support group. Hello, my name is Julia Turner, and I like This Is Us.
Dana,
I mean, hurdles. Like, okay, I'm going to stake out the same position. I'm not even doing it to oppose you guys, but my honest reaction to this show was that it was sort of the crash babble style, you know, sprawling story.
Grand
Canyon.
Brings
many threads together, right? With all the sentimentality and the kind of faux concern with social issues that entails, or maybe not faux, but let's say superficial engagement with social issues that entails. That it was, as you say, Steve, well-crafted and well-put together, and the twists at the end were true twists. You know, they weren't just throwing in a sort of, you know, random wrench into the works. They were a new piece of knowledge that somehow shifted your understanding of all of these characters, and that's cool. So, yeah, there's somebody who's putting together a well-crafted machine, but what that well-crafted machine is trying to do, I wouldn't quite say it's reprehensible, but it's encouraging viewers to be comfortably dumb, I would
you
say.
You are cold, Stevens. That was an ice cold
comfortably
reading.
Comfortably dumb. Oh, my Lord.
So, that's excellent. Talk about, so why do you guys feel the shame if you don't agree with me that there's some comfortable dumbness? Why do you shudder in shame at your own love for it?
That's a good question.
I think that is a very good question.
Because we know you're right.
Well, here's what I'd say. So Vulture had this piece that I thought was very interesting and wrongheaded but worth reading. About the, I believe it was called the safe progressivism of This Is Us. And that's undeniable. But, I mean, and you could say that it's cynical that NBC knew they would succeed with a show that kind of feels like a little bubble with all the delusions and blinkeredness that entails away from the kind of real productive progressivism that makes liberals confront their own privilege and unseen biases and things like that. It turns phony progressivism into a kind of lullaby for liberal viewers who want to watch something that has a slight tang but is fundamentally mild and gentle and safe. But I don't know. I feel like it was sort of subtler than people give it credit for on a lot of these issues. So I don't know if any of you saw the episode where – so to avoid giving a full spoiler, I will say that one character finds out that another character is gay. And there is this moment when he makes this face. And it's a character is very close to. He makes a face. It's not a judgmental face. It's just a, huh. And you see him – kind of integrating this new information. It's this great tiny moment of this well-intentioned, open-hearted liberal person getting his unconscious biases very faintly pinged. And it kind of makes a joke about how, you know, he's not weirded out per se, but he's sort of integrating this. I think that the show is more self-aware than anyone sort of gives it credit for. And it knows that it gets away with its sort of toothlessness by being so earnest and sweet, but it also has these decent, you know, truly good characters who are exactly the kinds of deluded, well-intentioned progressive this show may be targeting. And it's kind of a funny trick.
I do think I give the show credit for addressing emotional terrain that goes unaddressed elsewhere. You know, like the notion of two adult brothers who really aren't that close and were never close growing up. And like, what do you do with that relationship? Can you really start a new relationship with an adult sibling that you weren't close to as a child? Like, that's a real question that some people have in their lives and you don't often see treated. You know, you're more likely to get sibling relationships like Jamie and Cersei or whatever. So, you know, the show spends like it's a major plot of one whole episode, like these brothers, their relationship. What can happen between them? Can it grow? Which is like very small bore and emotionally interesting terrain. And the show is not glib about that. Similarly, the overweight character, Kate, you spend a lot of time like with her actual emotional struggles around eating and weight loss and temptation and willpower and just the emotional headspace of dieting and exercise. And that's a headspace where like a lot of people spend their time and it's treated with seriousness and respect in a way that feels actually quite fresh and not super exploitative, I think, of her.
I would just jump in and nuance that, though, Julia, with this the remark that Kate, who's played by Chrissy Metz, the overweight twin, female twin, is to a greater degree than I would like to see defined by her fatness and her relationship to her fatness and her self-consciousness about it. And she meets someone at her Weight Watchers group and they start to date. And it just seems, at least based on the first two episodes, that we're not going to get to know very much about Kate except for her lifelong trauma about her weight. And I just wonder how viewers of the show, who are large people, fat people, would feel about that and whether they would feel like she's being boxed.
She gets more interesting as the show progresses. Yeah. Like, she gets a job. She and her twin start to think through their tangled relationship and how codependent they are and whether that's healthy. I mean, I had that concern too, especially from the initial episode, which is just like all like her like staring at pieces of cake and sighing. And it's just like, come on, like this does not seem like a reasonable portrayal of an overweight person's emotional landscape and terrain. But and I'm sure there is still plenty to object to, but I think she gets a much broader range of interests and concerns.
Well, I mean, it's a funny performance, and I like the character. I just want to see more sides to her.
Also, I would say she's obsessed with losing weight, which is a drum that's beaten relentlessly. But within that, her struggles with insecurity are conveyed in deeply humane and nuanced ways. So she's funny and tough and calm, but she's also insecure about her lovability and her worth. And that is a more textured emotional arc than just staring longingly at a piece of cake.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I'll tell you one thing. Two things that I really liked about the show, in all seriousness. The first was I thought the sharpness of the writing over the Manny plot. So the successful, very hunky brother stars in a inane sitcom that he essentially hates being in but is making him rich and famous called Manny. And one of its gimmicks is that he walks around with his shirt off a lot of the time. And I thought all of that actually, I mean, I dislike Hollywood cannibalizing itself over and over and over again, which it's done way too much of over the last 10, 15, 20 years. I thought this was very funny. It was handled super, super cleverly. The bit with Alan Thicke, all of that I just thought was genuinely funny, very good writing. I would have watched that under any conditions. And then the second thing is, you know, the trend of my own life and of the viewing habits of people, you know, like me is so in the opposite direction of network TV, that you forget what one of the purposes of network TV was back in its kind of golden age of three channels, which in a way was to start at the center of American consciousness with extremely sentimental but widely shared values, and then expand out from that core to things that were possibly more nuanced or shades of gray or troubling. And of course, cable, premium cable is exactly the opposite, right? It starts on the very, very outermost fringe. The first, you know, old golden age of network flattered our American goodness. You know, you could argue that gourmet, you know, premium streaming TV flatters our sense of badness in ways that are preposterous. And it was something comforting in this day and age to start with something that began with that core, which has become tenuous and is actually a far more daring place and an interesting place to start than with, you know, drug dealers and you know, on and on and on villainy, you know, Walter White style villainy. That moment kind of has come and gone, and to build out from it. And I just think I was grateful for that.
Right. I mean, I agree that the sort of progressivism of the show is phony, it's safe and all those things, but it's also kind of the conceit of the show. This sort of rosy liberalism, this fake world in which decent people are just trying to muddle through and and everything works out in the end. That's what makes this show such escapist TV. This is just such a good ensemble show, which is coincidental because Sterling K. Brown is in it and he was also in People versus OJ. And it's just this web of relationships that are all so dense and persuasive. And then also this balance where this dynamic where the emotional balance never tilts too far in any one direction. So everyone sort of the narrative weight is nicely distributed among all these different stories. And it makes such a satisfying whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Although Sterling Brown is the standout.
Oh, he's incredible.
His performance and his character, I think, is the real heart of the show.
Yeah, completely agree. Okay, it's This Is Us. It's on NBC. It is network TV that we, by and large, liked, except for that incorrigible, self-serving cynic, Dana Stevens. Laura Bennett's the culture editor of Slate.com. Laura, thank you so much for coming back on the show. It is always a real pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, the great, and I mean great, television comedian Mary Tyler Moore has died. She first became widely known playing the wife of Dick Van Dyke on The Dick Van Dyke Show in the 60s, but her enduring contribution to American culture is her eponymous and still beloved television show, The Mary Tyler Moore Show, about a 30-year-old single woman making a life as a newswoman in Minneapolis. It is a double icon, the rare double icon. I think it's iconic as television comedy. It is iconic as feminism of a certain low-key but very definite variety. It is also just simply, I think, just without question, one of the funniest and most beloved television shows of all time. I grew up with it. It was mother's milk to me. Let's listen to a clip.
Look, miss, would you try answering the questions as I ask them?
Yes, Mr. Grant, I will, but it does seem that you've been asking a lot of very personal questions that don't have a thing to do with my qualifications for this job.
You know what? You got spunk.
Well,
I hate spunk. Tell you what, I'll try you out for a couple of weeks, see if it works out. Oh. If I don't like you, I'll fire you.
Right, right.
You don't like me, I'll fire you.
Yes, yes. That certainly seems fair.
All right, well, Julia, I'm going to start with you. You are the child of a newswoman, and you are a newswoman yourself. Surely this character meant quite a lot to you.
Yeah, I mean, the Mary Tyler Moore Show, I think for people of my generation, we know it from reruns on Nick at Night. It was part of the Nick at Night retro programming block in the early 90s. And I watched it a bunch and loved it. And also watched Murphy Brown a bunch at that time. So like feminist fictional newswomen are like a key parts of my televisual psychic landscape. But I was watching episodes again this weekend trying to understand what made me respond to the show so strongly as a teen. And I think the show offered a model of feminism that felt very appealing. I mean, feminism in general was very appealing to me. My mother was a avowed feminist and spoke a lot about her concerns in the workplace. And, you know, it's not like that was an alien concept that was introduced to me by Mary Tyler Moore. I was raised in fertile soil for such ideas and such role models. But she just made it seem so fun and natural and easy and obvious to just be independent-minded and smart and to have spine and to care about the world and other people and have a point of view and a perspective and have an independent life and not assume that it would be better to marry a bozo than be single, and that pursuing your own ideas was obvious. Like, she made it seem like, duh, you're a feminist. Like, duh, this is just the obvious way one goes about one's life. And you can be as charming as Mary Tyler Moore and wear as many primary 70s color geometrically striped outfits. And it just seemed great. I don't, even watching it again, I had trouble putting my finger on the exact appeal, but I think she just made it look obvious and fun to be what I strived to be as a kid.
Yeah. So role modeling aside, Dana, it's just one of the great television shows of all time. What did it mean to you?
Well, like you, I grew up in the era when it was first on the air. I think I was four when it debuted in 1970. And I have, I mean, there's really not a memory of a Saturday night in that part of my childhood that doesn't include ritual Mary Tyler Moore watching back to back with Bob Newhart and the rest of that great programming block on Saturday nights with my family. So she was a very, very early image of, yeah, what it was to be an adult. And I wrote about this a little bit in a blog post I wrote after she died for Slate. But I think Julia kind of captured it with what she was saying about the spontaneity and the kind of the ease with which she seemed to inhabit this role that was, in fact, unbeknownst to children like us at the time, was this socially new and radical role. And in fact, in the early stages of planning of the Mary Tyler Moore Show, she was supposed to be a divorcee who was starting life again. But they decided that was too scandalous. They couldn't have a main female character who had been divorced. And so they made her having broke up with a fiancé instead, something that was very rarely referenced after the first episode of the show. But that that was Mary's background. I was watching some episodes of it with one of my best friends who came for the Women's March with me. I think we talked about this in Plus last week, Steve. And she stayed for the week after. So when Mary died, she was around. And she and I have an old history of loving Mary and Rhoda and watching them together and have this kind of running joke that I'm Mary and she's Rhoda. And so we watched a few episodes of both Mary and the spinoff Rhoda with Valerie Harper, which is also a great show. And and something that I was really noticing from episode one of the Mary Tyler Moore Show is that it takes place in a women's world. You know, it really does. I mean, she works with all men. And so there in the workplace, there are sometimes moments, for example, where she has to ask Mr. Grant for a raise because her predecessor, a male, was making more money than her. But in the domestic spaces, when you're in Mary's wonderful apartment with the wooden M on the wall, it's Phyllis knocking on the door, her landlady to come in and chat about her problems, and it's Rhoda coming from downstairs to bitch about something. And it really is this kind of coffee clutch of women, you know. So in that way, I think as a child, it seemed really utopic to me, too. It was sort of, yes, you go to this cool office workplace and wear the neat geometrically striped pantsuits, and then you go home and your best friend lives right upstairs and you get to hash out all your problems with her, you know. So it was this vision of single young womanhood that was so appealing to a child that it would never have occurred to me that, you know, she should have been looking for a man, yes, or that this was a way station on the way to getting her MRS degree or something like that.
It's also, I had forgotten that she doesn't get married at the end of the run. Like, even Liz Lemon got fucking married and had a baby at the end of the run, right?
The show is just not oriented that way, not at all.
And in fact, it got less and less so. I think in the early seasons, there would be more things about her dating and could she find the right guy. But pretty soon, the relationships in the office with Ted and Murray and Sue Ann Nivens and all the hilarious characters of WJMTV became so much richer than, you know, just watching her boyfriend woes. That it began to focus more on that.
I mean, rewatching it, I was really curious about a couple things. One, how revolutionary does it really feel retrospectively from this point of view of this day and age? And secondly, does it hold up as a comedy? And amazingly, both things are really evident from the pilot episode. I mean, in the first 2 minutes of the pilot episode, you have a scene featuring a single career woman and a clearly Jewish character. I think these were highly unusual types to be promoted on. I mean, it was only several years after she had been in the very black and white kind of 50s holdover Dick Van Dyke Show. She's in a new universe in the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and it was very open about that from the beginning. Simply as an office comedy, I think it's got to be the first one, right? That television station gave birth to, I mean, it is not an exaggeration to say hundreds of shows that were built on exactly that template. I don't really know which one, what sitcom preceded it as a workplace drama filled with social types, at the center of which is this character we heavily identify with as kind of the normal one at the center of. So there's Murray, the office wit, Sue Ann, the sex pot underminer, Ted Baxter, the vainglorious newscaster. And then, of course, you know, deathlessly, there's Lou Grant, the whiskey-soaked, you know, sort of cynical softy.
Who, can I add, in the first episode, Lou Grant shows up drunk at Mary's door after her very first day of work. The most inappropriate call the HR office thing that could possibly happen in today's work universe. And it's kind of treated as just a funny moment on the show. There's my drunk boss wandering over to my apartment at night.
Yeah, that is true. And then the other thing, a couple points I want to make quickly is that yes, she's spunky in the famous words of Lou Grant. She's you know, cheerful, upbeat. But Mary Tyler Moore brought a completely new dimension to that character, and in a way to television, which is that underneath there's real melancholy and confusion, which was very much a part of Mary Tyler Moore's repertoire as an actress. It came out in Ordinary People, that tragic, disappointed, slightly rigid side to her personality, really became manifest in that performance, which is incredible. But it's there in Mary Richards, too. I mean, she's not simply a normal, perky, happy, well-adjusted person at the center of the show. There's an element melancholy really is the word. And then the second thing is just how funny the best episodes are. The really famous standout episode that, like, the kind of, if you're going to watch one, watch this one, is the Chuckles the Clown episode, which I rewatched. I was laughing hysterically. As comedy, it completely holds up. We should say that the show was the brainchild and no small part of James L. Brooks, who went on to have a huge career in both feature films and TV. In terms of endearment, The Simpsons, the early work of Wes Anderson. I mean, so many things bear the fingerprints of James L. Brooks, and the show was the original one, as far as I know.
Can I say a couple words about the melancholy that you just pointed out?
I'd love to hear them, yeah.
I hadn't realized until reading obituaries of Mary Tyler Moore what a hard life she had and what a difficult past she was channeling in her work, because as you say, she is this, you know, delightful light comedian. She also did do roles like Ordinary People, where she could pull off, you know, much more serious acting roles. But you think of her as this sunshiny creature who can turn the world on with her smile. And in fact, both her parents were alcoholics. And for that reason, she lived from early childhood with an aunt instead of with them. And she also went through a period of alcoholism, I think, beginning early in her career at the Dick Van Dyke Show period. She had one child who died of an accidental gunshot wound at age 24 or something. I mean, her life was really studded with these awful, awful stories. And so that gave a different dimension to thinking about that sparkle that she had. And, you know, I don't know exactly where you see the melancholy. I'd love to see some of the episodes that you see the melancholy Mary Richards in the Mary Tyler Moore Show. But something that you often see in her character that I really identify with, I mean, she was a feminist in the sense that she was trailblazing in the workplace, but she was also, she had real boundary issues. There were many, many episodes of Mary Tyler Moore that revolved around her not being able to say no to someone, getting in over her head by being too nice, right? Having to learn to sort of draw boundaries with people. There's one where Phyllis becomes her assistant, her office assistant, because Lou Grant says, you have so much extra work, I'll let you hire an assistant. And out of niceness, and because her landlady Phyllis is bored in her jobless life, she lets her become her assistant, and Phyllis, of course, is a horrible assistant and eventually has to be fired. But there seemed to be a lot of plots that had to do with that. Mary is too nice, and what is she going to do about toughening up to get through this problem in the workplace? And I think, you know, as much in the 70s as now, that's something that probably women in the workplace struggle with. So I appreciate that was also a part of the show, and it was a very funny part of the show.
Yeah, she could have used some coaching lessons from Isabelle Huppert.
Oh, yeah, she had none of that toughness. I mean, just think of that Mary stammering smile. You know, she had a certain kind of fake smile that she would put on when she was saying yes to something that she really knew she shouldn't be saying yes to. And that was something that returned again and again in the show.
All right. I will say without equivocation that in the history of the sitcom form, a major American popular art form, I rate the Mary Tyler Moore Show as number one.
Whoa.
We had this conversation before, I think, all-time TV rankings, and Mary was way, way up there for me. I mean, it's the whole package, you know? It's the style, the ensemble acting, the incredible theme song. Just when that little twinkly sound before the theme song starts, you just know you're in for a half hour of joy.
It's Pavlovian. Yeah, I totally agree. All right, well, Mary Tyler Moore, a woman who gave took of an extraordinary gift and gave it beautifully to all of us. Highly recommended to people who haven't seen the show. Seek it out. It's on Hulu, Amazon. Pay a buck. Watch some of these episodes. They're fantastic. Piece of television history. All right. Well, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse Dana. What do you have?
That's a good one, Steve.
Yeah, that was a nice little extra wiggle at the end of the last A. So I was going to do a serious endorsement this week because I've read so many very well-written and very chilling analyses of what's happening, what nightmarish things are happening in the political sphere this week. But instead, I'm going to go with a goofy escapist endorsement for this time and maybe get serious next time. So there's these creators of song parodies that my daughter has gotten me into on YouTube. They have their own YouTube channel. Their names are Dustin and Genevieve. I think they're a couple, either a married couple or at least engaged to be married. And they make these very amateurish and yet very hilarious parody videos of popular songs where they rewrite the lyrics and kind of act them out. It all seems to be filmed with an iPhone around their house. And it's extremely DIY, but extremely endearing and clever. And the particular one I recommend that you start with on your Dustin and Genevieve journey is their parody of Circle of Life, the song from The Lion King, which they turn into a song about social media and the ills of social media. And I just want to play for you the very, very beginning of the song so that you can catch some of the charm of the Dustin and Genevieve magic.
Time to check my social media, yeah.
To see who loves me online.
Hashtag blessed life. Time to post a pic with an inspirational quote.
It's deep and we'll get loud.
So this song goes on and on with Dustin and Genevieve posing in various, you know, beautiful beach-like locations and scrolling dramatically through their Instagram feeds. And it's become sort of an anthem around my house. So when my daughter thinks we're spending too much time online and she sees me checking something on my phone, she'll start bellowing, "Time to check my social media." Anyway, it's one of those things that grows on you the more you watch it. And then you start watching their Adele parodies and their various other parodies. And they have a comedic album, which I haven't bought yet. But just the idea of this goofy couple of total non-professional performers having fun writing fake lyrics for songs and acting them out is a very endearing thing. It's sort of the best of YouTube. And so I recommend Dustin and Genevieve's YouTube channel. We'll put a link on the show page.
I will check that out. That does sound appealing.
That's hilarious. Julia, what do you have?
I would like to recommend a book. The book is When in French by Lauren Collins, who's a wonderful writer for The New Yorker. It's a memoir. They meet in London speaking English, but then move to Geneva, and in an effort to have something to do in that city, which she doesn't like very much, and to understand her husband better, she sets out to learn French, which is his native tongue. It's just a great, astute piece of writing. It's full of interesting little observations about the differences and disjunctures between cultures that you can discover when you get really immersed in another language, and how those can affect your relationships and what it means to really love someone in a second language, and the conflicts and opportunities that arise there. And it's worth reading right now, I think, as a document of an attempt at cultural understanding. I feel like we are living in a moment of great cultural conflict, and it's a really humane and sympathetic and wonderfully turned book. So the book is When in French by Lauren Collins. It's a wonderful memoir for anyone you know who speaks French or aspires to speak French or is just interested in language and learning languages and how they work.
She's wonderful, Lauren Collins. I am very psyched to read that book. All right. Well, for my endorsement, double endorsement very quickly. First, I love the Mary Tyler Moore theme song. I loved it even more when Husker Du, the great Minneapolis punk rock band, covered it. It was a B-side, one of their singles. You can
I linked to that cover in my little write-up of Mary. It's one of the best song covers ever because it
completely
preserves the spirit of the original song while finding something new in it.
Yeah. And then on a slightly less light note, I don't know if I've ever quite endorsed this. I might have mentioned it in another endorsement, but I want to return to it, which is an essay by the Czech playwright. And of course, it became the president of post-communist Czechoslovakia, Václav Havel. The essay is called The Power of the Powerless. It should be considered a modern classic. It's essentially Havel was either in prison or about to be in prison or in and out of prison when he wrote it in the mid-70s. And it was trying to get at the nature of a somewhat peripheral communist regime. So in other words, he wasn't living in Moscow. He wasn't at the center of the Soviet Empire. He was living in a society that was dealing with the Soviet boot in a slightly indirect way, or somewhat indirect way. I mean, in many respects, quite a direct way. In 68, Soviet tanks had gone into Prague and were ready to go again. Nonetheless, he felt that novel ideological terms were necessary in order to understand the reality that he was living under. And so he coined the phrase post-totalitarian society, post-democratic society. And he was what drew me to the essay initially was it seemed to me someone like Havel was attempting to find non-ideological ways to understand our yearning for human freedom as it's squeezed by ideological categories and by power. It's available online in PDF form. I highly recommend reading it at one's earliest convenience. It is a modern classic, and it is sadly utterly relevant to our present moment. All right, Dana, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Julia, thanks. That was wonderful.
Thanks, guys.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page, slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Verilyn Williams. Our intern is Daniel Schrader.
Daniel Schrader, who, we should say, has his first author byline on Slate this week with a post about throwing shade on TV land. So check that out.
Oh, fantastic. Congrats to Daniel Schrader. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lichtai. And Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network. Culture Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of like-minded and unlike-minded shows, a wonderful diversity of shows at itunes.com/panoply. Our Twitter feed is at Slate Cult Fest. Julia Turner and Dana Stevens. I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you soon.